Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley. I hope you're very well on a Monday. Now, coming up on today's episode, as George Osborne's deputy at the Treasury throughout the coalition years, Danny Alexander was a co-architect of austerity. He then lost his seat in 2015 and went off to work for the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. Well, he's back at his native Scotland for the COP26 talks. And I caught up with him to ask about everything from China to the coalition and are the Lib Dems ever going to come back? Because that's coming up as our big thing on today's episode. But first, as ever, it's our columnist panel. It's Monday, so it must be Libby Rachey. It's Libby Purvis and Rachel Sylvester. Now, I wanted to start this. It feels like there's a couple of different things that we can pull together the threads on. And I suppose all of it is, the big question is Boris Johnson, global statesman. How... an excellent noise there from Libby. Because we've got, obviously, COP26, and there is even some debate as to whether or not, you know, a success at COP26 is with it, even within his gift or, you know, within his grasp. But then we've also got this row with France and over fish and, you know, imminent war with France. And then you've got the sort of the broader question of Britain's place in the world and, you know, relations with, you know, the rest of Europe, the rest of the world. Libby, explain your noise.
Well, it's just the most enraging political nonsense about the fishing, and for once it is actually Macron who is at fault. These are small numbers of small boats which say they're entitled to licences. A lot of them apparently don't have the right logbook documentation to show they always fished there before. On top of that, scallop dredging is environmentally awful anyway. It screws up the seabed badly. And then we get this extraordinary Castex letter saying it's important to demonstrate to the EU that leaving the EU makes things worse for people. In other words, must make sure Britain sweats for having done it so we can frighten the Poles and the Hungarians into staying. This is a piece of so scummy politics, bang in the middle of an important COP meeting, that it takes your breath away. It really does. And I'm a Francophile.
Wow. Scummy politics. Rachel, your take on it.
Well, I have to say I'm a bit more even-handed about it. I think it's scummy politics on both sides. You know, Boris Johnson, he's supposed to be showing global leadership at the moment, but he seems to be picking fights left, right and centre. So I think the fishing thing, it's the Brits are equally at fault to the French, as far as I can work out. And then meanwhile, you've got Northern Ireland.
Is that right, Rachel? Haven't we just done what we said we were going to do? That if you could prove that you've been fishing in those waters, you could have a licence. That's what we've done.
Isn't the problem that it's quite hard for some of these boats to prove they were fishing? And there was a French politician this morning suggesting, look, can't the authorities from both sides just sit down and agree a list of boats that should be allowed? And the Brits won't even go there. So I think it just feels like we are picking fights too. And meanwhile, you've got Northern Ireland this morning, you know, a bus hijacked and set alight in Northern Ireland. That's all really teetering on the brink with Lord Frost throwing his weight around, refusing to abide by the agreement that he drew up, or, you know, trying to tear that up and start again. And if you want to show global leadership, you have to make friends and not make enemies, left, right and centre.
But Rachel, do you not feel that that Castex letter, sort of saying it is important to demonstrate that leaving the EU makes things worse for people, that is pure politics?
Totally.
And because they're afraid of other countries moving out. That's just atrocious.
Yeah, I agree. And that's incendiary on the other side. But I don't think Boris Johnson and Lord Frost have been trying to build bridges. They've been trying to blow them up, and for political gain too, because they want to pander to their Tory Brexiteers and make sure that we've got, that they're shoring up their position by picking a fight with everyone.
But I suppose if Boris Johnson was behaving like Emmanuel Macron, British Remainers would be going wild. And actually, aren't we just saying, well, these are the rules as we laid down. This was the deal. That's it. That's the you know. And actually, unusually, I would say, Boris Johnson and Liz Truss and George Eustace last week are not escalating this in the slightly jingoistic way that they might have done in the past.
But that's precisely what we're not doing over the Northern Ireland Protocol. We're saying, we want to go back to the drawing board, rip this all up, start again. Oh, it was the agreement we signed. Oops, no, now we want to redraw it all. So the problem is I do think it's on both sides. I mean, the COP thing just reminds you how big the questions and the challenges are that the West faces, and yet we can't work together.
I suppose that's the thing, isn't it, Libby? That we're sticking to our agreement when it comes to French fishing boats, but we aren't when it comes to the rest of the deal that we signed and now don't like.
Yes, it makes me terribly sad, because my central thought here is that great tragedy is that Boris Johnson is not Rachel, because somebody as even-handed and as sensible as that would probably resolve this. You know, Rachel for Prime Minister, you know, and then Boris can come on, surely, and witch her away with us on a Monday.
Yeah. Well, maybe Rachel Sylvester for Prime Minister. That seems like right. Fine. We've sorted that. We've sorted that one out.
No, I'm turning it down.
As ever. That's the first thing that should disqualify someone from becoming Prime Minister is the desire to do the job.
Exactly.
They should be immediately struck off. Libby, let's talk about your column today. A completely different topic. But looking at domestic violence, and actually in the wake of the murder of David Jackson.
I should say it's not domestic violence in the wake of. It is very specifically about this particular Jackson case, because what we're getting now is some comparisons with the Sally Challen case, which is frankly different as chalk and cheese if you look at their histories. But there's this sort of move saying, oh, well, because she's a woman, she must have been abused and bullied. Therefore, she loses all self-will. Therefore, she loses all responsibility. Therefore, she is guiltless. And it's at least a very mild manslaughter sentence, and it's not murder. And I just wanted to reiterate that while there are cases of long-term victims who couldn't escape and suddenly snapped, this was not one of those. It's quite clear from all the evidence, and I read everything that there was. If women are equal and have equal rights, we also have equal responsibilities of self-control. And in this case, she was the one with the knife. She was the one who then didn't help him but stabbed him again twice. It's clear that neither of them were saints, but treating women as automatically guiltless because they're innately so helpless is not a kind of feminism I can sign up to. And so, I mean, I had a lot of hesitation as to whether to write this, and I'm quite interested that a fair number of people are agreeing with me below the line, but obviously a great deal will not. And some people will always say, no, 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 you know, a woman who snaps, you know, it's because she must have been so badly abused emotionally and we can't, you know, see inside. But I can't go along with that this time, not having read about this particular case. So it's specifically about this case and the particular callousness of this case.
And I suppose the point is, Libby, trying to portray this particular case as being a, you know, downtrodden woman, the victim essentially in all of this, it actually does a disservice to those who are genuinely in that situation.
I think it does a disservice to all of us. I think we have to say, you know, there was a time in history when women were chattels, were victims, had no rights at all, really only a couple of centuries back. But now we do. And therefore, we have to take on the responsibility. One of those responsibilities is if you think you are going to, you can't bear being near somebody, you do not pick a knife and go at them with it. You just don't.
What's your take on this, Rachel?
It just seems so sad, the whole case. And I feel so torn about it. So I do agree with what Libby's saying to some extent. But then also, I think there is a genuine issue of coercive control and relationships where women feel emotionally trapped. And you can say, oh, don't pick up a knife, walk away. But actually, people feel that they can't do that. And the Sally Challen case that you mentioned, Libby, was a good example of that. Her murder conviction was quashed after years of coercive controlling by her husband. And it just, I don't know, I feel very, I think you're right, Libby, but also I just don't know really what happened in this relationship. I suppose you have to listen to what the judge said, and he said he was sure that the victim was nothing like the person she claimed. But also they clearly, neither of them were saints, and clearly she had been through a lot. I just felt
yes,
that
I think
there
I
was
just, a, it's a suggestion a that they both went that, through a lot.
Yeah. But there's a danger of saying that this coercive control, sort of snap out of it. And actually, I don't think that is true. I interviewed Rosie Duffield, the Labour MP who'd been in a coercive controlling relationship. And she described so powerfully how, you know, her friends would say to her, this is bad for you, you know, leave him. And she just somehow couldn't. And it was very hard to, rationally, it's hard to understand, but she felt he loved her, and she felt she loved him, and that she was trapped in that very deep level.
You don't pick up the knife. You just don't. And I mean, this is not the kind of coercive control where the woman couldn't leave the house. This was a woman who went out, who had friends, you know, who went to the gym all the time, all that sort of thing. You know, obviously the lockdown made things very hard for them. But you just have to say, just because you are really upset and piqued and feel you've been badly done by, the thing you do not do is pick up the knife.
There's a danger in this sort of discussion about coercive control and those who are genuinely victims in that case. It's still not all right to murder the other person. It is understandable, and I suppose it's mitigation that, in the face of, or if all else fails and that was the only option, and in the heat of the moment and after months or years of trauma, that is an explanation. But we can't be in a situation where it becomes okay to kill someone else because of the situation you were in. I suppose that's the point, isn't it, Libby?
Of course not. Libby, I'm interested, why do you think the Sally Challen case is different then?
Because I've read a lot about both of them, and you know, the age at which Sally Challen first met this man when she was 15, you know, there was a lifelong history of that kind of dominance. You also have all the various evidence from different people at the trial about the Jackson case, just a totally, totally different picture. Mm-hmm. But there is a very great danger of letting women off for all sorts of reasons out of guilt, because the misogyny and persecution of women in the past, which I totally acknowledge, and some of it's still happening now in some quarters, and my goodness, in some parts of this country, in some communities, because of that, there is this terrible temptation to say we must always be very soft on women, whatever they do. And as a woman wanting the dignity of being a woman, I can't ever just take that.
Well, it's a fascinating case. And as you were saying, Libby, there's loads of comments underneath your column today, and actually lots of them saying that not everyone agrees as ever, but lots of them saying, you know, thank you for that refreshing common sense attitude. As a feminist, I'm astonished that some feminists are berating the judge and join this case and demand that Penny Jackson be free. Do they not read the same reports that I or Libby did? You can continue that conversation. Go online to thetimes.co.uk.
Can we talk about tiramisu now?
I was going to, exactly right.
Desperate
I
wanted to make sure
I was, that's why I was carefully winding it up and slightly shifting the mood, Libby, before we talked about the most important thing, which is the father of tiramisu has died at the age of 93. He'll be presumably laid to rest in layers of cream and chocolate.
Mascarpone.
Yes, he's Addo Campiol, the father of tiramisu, who died at the age of 93. Go on then, Libby, give us your views on tiramisu. Are they going to be as controversial as everything else?
Well, I love it. I just love the way that it's very recently invented and it's now traditional Italian. It even gets quoted in that, I think it's in Sleepless in Seattle, where the guy is scared of starting dating again and he says, oh, tiramisu, what's that? Do I have to do that to her? What is it? but I also love the fact it's not the first time a traditional dish was actually invented a few years back, because tartiflette, which people think is, oh, traditional Swiss Savoie Alps, it was dreamed up in the 80s as a special way of selling more reblochon cheese, and it was boosted by Le Syndicat Interprofessionnel du Reblochon. You know, so I love the idea that you can invent a new traditional dish and flog it to the world, and especially to the Brits, who are so gullible about these things. it's wonderful. So God bless the tiramisu guy.
Yeah, tiramisu. It was only added to their menu in 1972. That's how recent it is.
But also that we love it as Brits, that sort of cosmopolitan food fad. And it was in the age where, you know, I grew up with Angel Delight, and butterscotch Angel Delight was the most sort of innovative thing that was bad. Do you remember?
Now you're talking. Yeah.
But then suddenly tiramisu is the latest thing. And actually how, you know, we do rather love new things, and we love food from all around the world. And, you know, avocados were the most bought items on Waitrose around the country, not just by millennials. And there is that sense that we won't really want to go back to trifle and mushy peas, apart from as a kind of nostalgia comfort food.
It's gloop. I mean, that's the great thing, is that tiramisu is absolute gloop, and so is smashed avocado. It's because the British have such terrible teeth, isn't it?
Libby Purvis and Rachel Sylvester there, and of course you can read them both in The Times every week. Just get yourself a digital subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox. Up next, I speak to Danny Alexander.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers, with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com. Code program.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times Radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
How would that go in the booth?
Badly. Go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times Radio app.
You're listening to the Red Box Podcast. Now it's my interview with Danny Alexander.
Now then, for 5 years, Danny Alexander was at the heart of British politics. As George Osborne's Lib Dem deputy at the Treasury during the coalition years, he was a co-architect of austerity, telling departments how much they had to save and insisting public services could cope. But he lost his seat in 2015 and went on to become now Vice President for Policy and Strategy, the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank based in Beijing. Now he is back in the UK in his native Scotland for the COP26 summit. And he joins me now live from Glasgow. Morning, Danny.
Matt, good morning. How are you?
I'm very good. I'm very good. It's nice to speak to you. How long has it been since you've been back in Scotland?
Well, I was last year in February last year. And then I went back to Beijing in March 2020. And I haven't. This is my first trip since that time. So it's a long time.
And have you managed to get into the blue zone this morning?
Yes, after a fair bit of queuing in the security queue, but I'm here now. Yes, just inside the conference venue. So that's all been successfully navigated.
Very good, very good. Right, let's start at the beginning then for people who don't know. What is the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank? What does it do?
So the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank is a multilateral development bank. So like the World Bank or the IMF or the European Investment Bank, it's a group of countries have come together to set up this institution. In our case, now we have 104 member countries around the world. And the purpose is to invest in infrastructure projects that support the sustainable economic development of Asia. So our members have contributed in total $100 billion of capital to AIB. And then we use that money to finance projects, especially in low and middle income developing countries in Asia, to support their economic development, to support their sustainability, to support their green transition. And so we've committed that at least 50% of our financing will be for climate financing by 2025, and that by 2030 we expect to commit at least $50 billion to climate-related projects in Asia. And obviously, the needs in Asia are huge. Countries in Asia are going to be among the hardest hit by climate change if we don't deal with it. And multilateral institutions like ours are critical to mobilizing the finance that's necessary to actually achieve the outcomes that those countries need.
So just explain to me exactly the sort of thing you're investing in. Are you still investing in coal, gas, oil projects?
We've never invested in coal, and we won't do so. We invest in a lot of different energy projects, principally renewable energy, but also gas projects in some of our developing member countries where that's necessary and part of their climate transition. We've just announced that we will be aligning all of our projects with the Paris Agreement by the middle of 2023. That's something that all of the international financial institutions have been working on together. And so we're all doing that together. And that means that even if a project isn't strictly related to climate, it has to show that it's in line with the overall goals of the Paris Agreement. For gas, what that means is that we have to show that it's part of a country's transition plan, and that it fits in with the other aspects of Paris alignment. And so that's our approach on those issues.
I mean, obviously, you talk about the impact of climate change on Asia, but obviously, Bangladesh is not the problem when it comes to climate change. It's China. What role does the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank have in Chinese policy? What's the role of the Chinese government in the bank?
So we don't have any role in Chinese policy. We're an international institution, not a Chinese one. China is a major shareholder in AIB, and so they're obviously part of the decision-making process in the bank alongside all the other members. You may remember that the UK joined the AIB at the end of the period of the coalition government that I was part of. And so we have members from all over Asia, most European countries. Canada's a member. We have members in Latin America and Africa. So they all decide the policies together. We apply high environmental standards to all of our projects. And so when we're financing projects in China, just the same as in any other country, we apply the same kind of standards and approach as we would anywhere else. For AIB, India is the largest borrower from the bank at the moment. About a quarter of our financing is in India. And then we have a lot of projects in Bangladesh, in Pakistan, in Indonesia, in Turkey, in China, and in many other parts of Asia. Obviously, it's a new institution, so we're still growing. And so we expect the number of countries that we invest in to grow, and of course, the amount of financing in total to grow as well.
And what's the connection? Can countries who receive investment from the bank, do they have to, as has been suggested by some critics, sort of declare loyalty to China? Are they able to be publicly critical of Beijing? Or is this actually Beijing using its economic weight, if you like, to extend its tentacles around the world?
No, those claims are not true. There's no relationship between AIB financing and bilateral relations with China. We finance projects strictly according to the quality of the project, Is it going to make a difference in terms of economic development? Is it going to make a difference in terms of climate change? We apply the same criteria on an objective basis. So any of our members can come to us and say, we have a project, maybe a renewable energy project or a road development or a railway. We'd like AIB to finance it. And then we apply the same kind of standards and approaches wherever that project is, irrespective of the politics. You know, we're an international institution. We have to be objective in these matters. I'm no longer a politician. I'm an international civil servant. So, you know, we have to be politically neutral in everything that we do.
But I suppose if you're making the decision to be green in your investments, that's a political decision. So are there any other considerations that you take into account when you're making those decisions? You know, is human rights an issue, for instance? It's all over the papers again today. Liz Truss, reported by The Times, to have said that in a meeting that genocide was taking place against the Uyghur Muslims in the Xinjiang province. Is that something that you take into account? Is that something you agree with?
So when we're financing projects, we try to make sure that they're environmentally sustainable. We have safeguards for that. Socially sustainable. So we have safeguards for example, of course, major infrastructure projects can often have a big impact on local people. So if people have to be resettled, the standards by which that is done, the level of compensation that is paid, obviously workplace safety, issues like forced labour. We have policies against those things which have to be applied in projects we finance. So the way institutions like the AIB or the World Bank work is that we have policies and those policies have to be followed in the projects that we're financing, wherever they are in the world. So we don't take a stance on these political issues. These policies have been agreed by all of our members as something that is appropriate to ensure that when we finance a project, it is done to high standards, it's done to high quality, and it's done in line with international best practice. And so where projects are concerned, we follow those rules absolutely. But I wouldn't get involved in commenting on internal political issues in any of our member countries. I would simply make sure that in the projects we finance, we're following those rules correctly.
I was just interested because, you know, when you were a Liberal Democrat cabinet minister, you know, you would have spoken up about issues on human rights and that sort of thing. And knowing that you were coming on today, I spoke to someone who'd served in the cabinet with you. It sort of described that, you know, since you left government, since George Osborne left government, China's rather fallen out of fashion in British politics. And that the phrase was used to me, are you the sort of acceptable face of Chinese colonialism now?
I wouldn't use that phrase about myself. I'd be very surprised if anyone else would use that phrase about me. I mean, you know, when we in the UK decided to join the AIB, it was because we saw the proposal for a new multilateral institution as a positive one, because multilateral institutions follow international law, they follow international norms, they operate according to high standards. And we felt that it was appropriate for the UK to be part of that in the way that we're part of many other multilateral institutions. So I know that's, you know, we've left the EU recently, but still the same basic idea still applies. And so the UK, I don't represent the UK in the bank. The UK is represented around the table by a Treasury official. I'm part of the management of the bank. But I would say that the UK plays a very significant and very constructive role in making sure that the AIB is, you know, living up to those standards and commitments exactly as, you know, we hoped and expected when we decided to join.
I mean, I suppose that the point is that in British politics, at least, there's been quite a shift against China since you were in government. The AAIB was suggested by China. It was launched at a ceremony in China. It's based in Beijing. And I just wonder whether you're entirely comfortable still with that alliance with China, given the huge criticism in the UK, whether it's, you know, the situation in Hong Kong, the Uyghur Muslims. You're clearly not concerned about that.
I'm comfortable working for a multilateral institution because I believe, you know, as you remember when I was in politics, Matt, we talked from time to time. I'm an internationalist. I believe in you know, having institutions, whether it's the AIB, the World Bank, the IMF, we're here at the COP26, which is the United Nations conference. The purpose of these kind of institutions is to create a framework of rules in which countries with different systems can work together to achieve common objectives. In the case of the AIB, the common objective is sustainable economic development in Asia. And that common objective is important, as we see today here in Glasgow, because to tackle climate change, we will have to ensure there is significant change both in developed countries and in developing countries. We have to meet the needs of developing countries very thoughtfully and carefully, because they also have very substantial development needs. And so having institutions that can implement those policies, that can contribute finance to help those countries develop, is enormously important. I'm very proud to work for one such institution. There are many in the world. And I think that it's you know, whatever the disagreements, the bilateral disagreements between member states, that's not a matter for me directly. But within an organization like the AIIB, you do have a framework of rules and norms which allows that cooperation to go forward. And, you know, I think the AIIB has been quite effective in that way. And I think in relation to climate, which is what we're here to talk about, you know, the contribution that the AIIB can make by investing in projects in developing countries in Asia, where the needs are huge, and also, by the way, where the impact on people will be the greatest of anywhere in the world, is really very important. We want to be a green institution. That's what we're building. That's what we're developing. And I think we can, you know, help to ensure that the very, very important goals that the UK has led here at COP26 can be achieved in practice by the way that we deploy our financing. And I think it's important that these institutions are able to do that. And I'm proud to be part of one such.
It's Matt Cholley speaking to Danny Alexander live from the COP26 summit in Glasgow. Just before we move on, we'll talk a little bit about British politics. On the specific question of China, China's pledged to bring its emissions to a peak by 2030 and cut them to net zero by 2060. Given what you know about the Chinese economy and the progress in investing in greener technologies and that sort of thing, is it economically and sort of practically, physically possible for that to be done sooner? Or is the sort of the makeup of the Chinese economy, is it possible for China to reach 2050, reach net zero by 2050? Is it a political decision or a practical one about it not being possible by until 2060, do you think?
I think for China, like for other major economies around the world, the decision to move to net zero is one that is enormously consequential. It involves changing almost every aspect of how people live, of how the economy functions, of how energy is generated. And you know, to shift your emissions from an upward trajectory to a rapidly downward one, and to change the way your economy works, is a massive challenge for any economy. And obviously, in China, the scale of their country is even greater. But look, I mean, one of the messages from this COP26 is that every country has to do more. And the thing that I've learned in China about the Chinese system is that when they make a commitment to do something, their system will get into gear and will deliver it. So my sense is that there's a lot of serious effort underway to do that. But in the context of COP26, obviously, you know, the world is coming together to try and keep 1.5 alive, as Boris Johnson said, and that will necessitate every country doing its utmost to achieve those goals. I think for developing countries in Asia and countries that still have a lot of economic growth ahead of them, that challenge is even greater. And that's why, especially for lower income countries, the world has to rally around, especially the developed world, and contribute the finance that is necessary to help those countries achieve their objectives, because they will not be able to do it by themselves. And they have, I think, you know, a right to expect that this transition should be made justly, and that those who have benefited, as we have in the Western world over many decades, from economic growth driven by pollution, among many other things, will contribute to helping others to solve those problems.
Daniel, let me bring you back to Britain now, a little bit of British politics. As I mentioned at the beginning, you were in the Treasury for all but a few weeks as Chief Secretary of the Treasury. George Osborne's deputy, essentially, during those coalition years. is the one of the co-architects of austerity and the economic plan back then. These days, austerity is a bit of a dirty word in Britain. Boris Johnson and Rishi Sunak much keener on spending money these days. Do you have any regrets about that? That actually maybe if you'd have taken the Boris Johnson, Rishi Sunak approach to the national finances, you might even still be an MP. You might even still be in government.
Well, look, I'm not going to comment on the current policies of the current government for the reasons I was saying earlier. I'm no longer involved in British politics. It's not for me to get into that. But I think, as I reflect back on my own time in government, I would say that the decisions we made were the right ones for the time. I'm sure each government has to face the specific circumstances of its time and work out what are the right decisions. As a coalition government, we had to accept some give and take between the two parties. So there were some things that, as Liberal Democrats, we would prefer not to have done, and vice versa. But I think at that time it was necessary. The current government, well, history will have to judge them in due course.
Let me ask you about, before you became Chief Secretary of the Treasury, you were very briefly the Scottish Secretary.
I was the youngest, shortest serving and arguably most successful Scottish Secretary in history.
We weren't there long enough for anything to go wrong. I mean, things could yet go wrong.
17 days, yes.
Things could yet go wrong in Scotland, of course. All the polls suggest support for Scottish independence is higher than it's been for some time. How concerned are you that the next time you make it back from Beijing to Scotland, it might not be still part of the UK?
Look, I'm not going to get into this issue in detail because I'm not part of Scottish politics anymore. I took an active part in the referendum in 2014 as one of the leaders of the UK government, and my views are well known. I suspect that every government around the world for the next few years will have to focus on how to restore economic growth after COVID, how to continue to improve the health of populations under these circumstances, and how to tackle climate change. And that seems like a big enough agenda to keep anybody busy for the next few years.
Just finally, then, away from politics, so I can see that you're not going to get too involved in that. Has Nick Clegg invited you to join the Metaverse yet?
No, he hasn't.
of all the things which have happened since you left government, is there anything weirder than those videos of Nick Clegg doing acting with Mark Zuckerberg, telling us all that we're going to play cards with robots in the Metaverse?
I haven't watched the videos, so
well, there's a treat for you.
I'll look them up after this interview and let you know.
Danny Alexander, thanks very much for joining us. Really good to speak to you. Just finally, Danny, what is the sort of atmosphere like there in Glasgow? Does it feel like a summit which is going to achieve something?
I mean, I think it's a pretty challenging environment because there are so many different things that have to be included. But I think there's what I get is a real sense of ambition, a real sense of people coming here because they want to take the right steps to minimise the extent that we can the amount of climate change and the impact it has on people. How that will play out, I don't know, but I think there's an awful lot of goodwill towards this process, and that's a very important way to start.
That's all we've got time for on this episode of the Red Box Podcast. Don't forget you can listen to me live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1 on Times Radio. We bring you the best bits here on the podcast. And if you're feeling particularly nice, why not rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts from?
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal, to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.